Hello and welcome to the Stansberry Investor Hour. I'm Dan Ferris. I'm the editor of Extreme Value and the Ferris Report, both published by Stansberry Research.
And I'm Corey McLaughlin, editor of the Stansberry Daily Digest. Today we talk with Jonathan Schaffner of MBO Partners.
Yes, Jonathan is a friend and colleague of our own colleague from Altimetry, Joel Littman. And those guys do a little bit of work together. It's very interesting stuff. Jonathan has spoken at our conference in Las Vegas. He'll be there again this year. And he served 25 years in the Army, including 5 years in combat. And the guy just knows, because of that and his career at MBO, he just knows a lot of stuff. So we're going to pepper him with a lot of questions, and you're really going to enjoy this. So let's go ahead and talk with Jonathan Schaffner. Let's do it right now. John Schaffner, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
I appreciate it, Dan. Always good to see you.
I have not interviewed you before, but our colleague Joel Littman has had some convos with you. I know he had one conversation with you at our conference in Las Vegas, which was interesting. I think I was about three drinks in at the time, so I'm not going to say I remember what it was about, but I remember enjoying it very, very much. So
everything's better at that point, you know?
Yeah. Yep. So when I sort of started looking into what you're all about, I don't know if I want to talk to you about military stuff or if I want to talk to you about what you do at MBO Partners. Maybe we should do both. A little of both.
I luckily have a depth of knowledge in both.
Okay, good. The topic of war has been on my mind a lot lately, and I want to bounce some things off of you. And I was reading about NATO, and I was reading about the history of it and sort of the situation in Europe and the Ukraine-Russia war, and I was just, I knew nothing about it. So when I read that, NATO is basically a defensive organization and that they bombed a European capital for 78 days in 1999, Belgrade, Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. I thought, that's not defensive. And it wasn't a NATO country and they hadn't attacked a NATO country. And that led me to looking into more. And I was just kind of shocked by how far off the mission they got. And I wondered if a guy like you, I knew we were going to be talking to you, and I wondered if a guy like you had a viewpoint about that. I know you were deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan, so maybe you don't have a view of Europe, but I sure would like to know what you're thinking about that.
Well, I'll tell you, so when I joined the Army in 1998, mm-hmm. we were in the middle of the Balkans issues, right?
Yeah.
And I got to my first unit, and that unit was deployed to Bosnia. And then shortly thereafter, we got deployed to Kosovo. We didn't do anything kinetic then. The Army aviation piece didn't, we did a lot more security operations, so kind of more traditional NATO operations. but Europe since then, most Americans don't, we don't pay a lot of attention to it, right? If you look at the map of Europe in 1998 and the map of Europe today, you'll see some kind of stark differences, right? Even countries. And no American thinks, wait, there's countries that have changed in the last 20 years in Europe.
Yeah.
We usually think of Europe as France, Germany, UK, right? Maybe, depending on your background, maybe some Spain, maybe some, Nordic countries, but Eastern Europe has been in flux since post-World War II. So if you look at, why NATO was formed, to protect from the Russian hordes. And then at the fall of the Russian hordes, we didn't dissolve the protective relationship, even though at the time we thought Russia was going to potentially even, there was even discussion of Russia becoming part of NATO at one point.
Yes.
Granted, it was very short-lived, very short-lived. Yes. But we can talk about investing in Russia, but let's save that for another time.
Yeah.
But the NATO organization has been, in some senses, a protector of Europe. It depends on which side of the line you're on. But it definitely has a significant interest in Europe. So they have their, you know, articles of protection where we, you know, all the ways we protect each other, but also that European interest where, you know, NATO might act a little bit or stretch the foundational documents a little bit to do things that they feel are good for the NATO members. Right. So it does have a little bit of a broad edict if you look at how we've applied it over the last, you know, 70 years. So it's interesting. And, you know, our interests in Eastern Europe haven't changed much. Our presence has, you know, if you look at how back when I first joined, it was just after the Cold War had started to cool because it didn't warm up. It was pretty warm for a while, but it started to cool. So our presence, you know, moving into Poland and other strategic spots in more Eastern Europe changed kind of the perspective. And then as we add more members, and then most recently, you know, our members up north, it really has changed the you know, circumstances quite a bit. But yeah, so it's been something that has had a foundation in European security, and that has taken a lot of different definitions over the years. I think that's what's driven, you know, some of the changes and differences that you've seen as you dig into what it was originally formed for versus what it is today, which is sort of back to what it was originally formed for, but there's that period in there of flux. So it's like any international relations, pretty complicated.
Yeah, it is complicated. And I don't know. I was disturbed by what I learned. I was disturbed by, you know, recordings of conversations with, like Victoria Nuland from the United States, who, you know, they were like, there was a recording of someone from the United States, actually two people, her and the, I think was it the Ukraine or Russian ambassador, talking about how they wanted the Ukraine outcome to be in 2014, like who they wanted to install in the government. I was shocked. I mean, you know, you hear about these things going on, but you don't get to hear the conversation happening. And it blew me away. Like I listened to it again and again and again. I was like, they're moving chess pieces. It's like something out of a movie. It just shocked me. I just have to say, maybe I'm naive. You're probably more sophisticated about these things, certainly more sophisticated about these things than I am, but I was just shocked. It blew me away. Anyway. So what I'm afraid of, though, is that the U.S. through NATO's machinations are going to get us into more trouble, and that there's always the potential for another, you know, Vietnam or Afghanistan to develop somewhere in the world. Just because of the way that the U.S., like we think we're the world's policeman. And, you know, before you know it, thousands of Americans are being killed over a period of decades, actually, in these places. And for what, you know, to replace the Taliban with the Taliban, you know, it's just.
So that's the thing. I always say, and I think I might have said it at Stansbury last year, but you know, now that I'm out of uniform officially, I can be a little more open with what I think. To an extent, right? Because I still have to remain employed. But,
right.
You know, what I always say is prior to World War II, and this is a generalization because you can find, you know, anecdotes, but prior to World War II and for World War II, we fought for something. Like you had a war for a purpose, right? Mm-hmm. And that post-World War II, we have gone to war for a purpose that is not the same as prior to that. So a lot more ideology is involved in the purposes in which we go to war. Now going to Afghanistan, the purpose was obvious, right? We were attacked and that was our response. And then you roll in the Iraq war, which the circumstances in which we went into Iraq were disputable, right? The facts that we believed at the time may not have been the facts on the ground. There are a lot of people that contributed to that, and a lot of people that get excited. And when people get excited, they don't make great decisions, to include Saddam Hussein, right? He was a little excited and said some things that he maybe shouldn't have said. And then our response was, again, excited. And then we said and did things that maybe we shouldn't have done, you know, in retrospect. For example, in Afghanistan, I was there in the very beginning, and literally in the beginning, and we get ready to move out, and they brought in a larger unit, right? And we were thinking, what are they going to do? You know, it's like, what are we going to do more here or bigger, right? And we all, us smart captains at the time, we were young military men, but we'd been in this thing and we'd seen it for 7 months. And we learned the country, which Afghanistan is a country unlike any other, like all countries, but this country was especially unique. You know, the graveyard of empires, you know, they called that for a reason. Mm. And we said, well, you know, if we come in, at least at the minimum, we need to build a road between Kandahar and Kabul, kind of the main two power centers of Afghanistan. And we all agreed, all the smart captains and majors agreed. And admittedly, some of those majors are now like retired three and four star generals, which is really funny. It makes me feel old, which looking at my picture in this with good lighting makes me feel old as well. I had to figure out how to have a better makeup guy guy. But I come back there. I'd gone to Iraq three times after that Afghanistan trip. Mm-hmm. So I show back up to Afghanistan 8 years later. And I was at, General Petraeus' headquarters. So at the highest levels, the theater command headquarters there. And the discussion was, how are we going to build this road between Kabul and Kandahar? And I just walk into that conversation and I literally am like, what have you been doing for the last 8 years? You know, it's like, what? Guys, you know, but, you know, we kind of sort of moved in that direction, never finished it. It's interesting. And then we left, obviously the circumstances are pretty, you know, dire and egregious, circumstances that we left, and our continued relationship with Afghanistan is puzzling, is about the best word that I can use in this podcast, without bumping your rating up. But, it's just, you know, we still maintain a relationship with our former enemies, but that's another conversation. We do that all over the world. But it's you know, what was that war for?
Yeah.
And that, you know, begs the question of, since, if you look at it since World War II, you talk about Vietnam, you talk about Iraq, you talk about Afghanistan, you look at Libya, you look at a lot of the countries we've gotten ourselves involved in, what was the war for? And that's not something you can clearly define, right? It's like, what do we get out of that? You know, it's interesting. I go on for a long time talking about, you know, being in Iraq and the oil field support contract, right, for the southern Iraq oil fields, didn't go to an American company. And we're sitting there guarding this, right? So it's like, well, why wouldn't we want to align those revenues back to America? Like, this, you know, something you go to war for. You want to at least have something to gain. But it's very interesting.
All right. Well, I don't want to get you fired. So maybe I don't want to hang on this topic and get you fired. Right. So let's just, maybe we should talk about, you know, what MBO Partners is. Maybe just give us a little, you know, overview and tell us what it is and what you do there.
Sure. So MBO Partners is a very interesting business. They're one of the businesses that works behind the scenes with a lot of big companies that, you know, you may have never heard of, right? What MBO Partners does is they work with contingent workforce model. So if you look at the way the workforce has been changing, you know, in the United States, there's a lot more independence. I'm not talking about Uber drivers and DoorDash guys and, you know, that kind of contingent work. I'm talking about, you know, professionals that are billing $100-$200 an hour to do strategy work, to do large scale program management, those kind of things, as IT and AI and all these things have made doing things more effective for a person in an office or in a business. It also,
there are a few of those people in Washington, D.C., aren't there? Just a few.
A couple. Yeah. And we talk about the Washington Tech 100 at some point, if you want, because that's, if you look at what that is, it's like, oh my gosh, everybody's headquarters moved into, you know, Northern Virginia and D.C. But yeah, so MBO provides a contingent workforce for those folks. So it allows me, especially on the federal side, to engage with literally hundreds of different companies about, when you start talking about people and workforce, you really get you know, behind the curtain on how the company's health is and what they're thinking and kind of where they're looking strategically when you're talking about where they're going to deploy people. So that's what I've been doing the last, couple of years at MBO Partners is really looking at helping these companies build a better workforce model to deploy against, growing requirements on the federal side.
Right. A lot of defense or no?
Yeah. So obviously, defense spending is the largest section of the budget that we can choose to spend, right? The Defense Department has picked up a ton of cyber, a ton of IT integration. They're really working to modernize a lot of things. If you peel back the onion, the U.S. government still runs on a whole lot of mainframe computers. So that actually has become a really specific specialization because those folks have kind of aged out of the workforce in a lot of cases. So how do you maintain these giant mainframes, which you have to have them healthy if you want to move them to the cloud, you want to put the old garbage on the cloud. It's definitely a boom right now. If you look at where government spending is and then healthcare, same story. A lot of the IT backbone for a lot of the federal programs and companies and federal supporting agencies has been, left behind in the tech boom of, we'll even say, the late 90s, given the continued reliance on mainframes.
All right. So it's funny, I mentioned, there might be a few of these people in Washington, D.C. And I always wonder, what the hell do they actually do? I mean, really, what do they do? And I'm sure a lot of people think that way. A lot of people think, how are you, you talk to a guy, there's something in the suit in front of you, but you're not sure if it's even a human. And you're just like, how does this person get $100 or $200 an hour? And right. I can't ever put it together. Like, you don't know what somebody, can do, but people make impressions. I worked in Alexandria for a few years in the late 80s. And I mean, I just kind of worked in publishing. I was able to use a software program that was becoming more popular at that time. And so we were publishing like what's called the Electronic Data Interchange Standard. And, just worked around that for a few years. And so I wasn't like a high level guy, but I wound up working at like, defense contractors and places. And the one defense contractor gig I had stood out because basically you showed up and they said, whatever you're making an hour, we're going to pay you more because we need you right now. And you can sleep on the couch and you can stay here as long as you want, but this shit has to be done. And don't bother me with the details. Just get this thing done by, X time frame. And I was working with this other woman on the job, and like, we didn't leave the place sometimes for like, 48 hours or something. And it was weird. And the folks I was reporting to didn't seem to know a lot. That was the thing that got me. The amount of time they said, I don't know, but I just need you to do this. It was always, I don't really know, but I need you to do this. So my question then is, having encountered these people inside the company who didn't know anything, at least on one occasion many years ago, admittedly, like, is that why people are charging $100, $200 an hour? And if so, why not just hire the $100, $200 an hour guy?
Right. So here's kind of the, get to it, right? So our government spends, $5+ trillion a year. They spend it, right? It's not investing, it's spent. Of that money, $600 billion, give or take, mm-hmm. goes to contractors. Now, some of those contractors build stuff, but a lot of those contractors are pro services guys, are IT guys, are strategists, or other administrative type of assistance to the government. So what we tend to do, because the government isn't a business, we spend money, we never really worry about returns, we worry about effects and impacts, right? Mm-hmm. But I think what really drives the not the value, but the spend is we change the goalposts all the time. So, hey, we're going to go this way and we're going to go to the cloud. Like, we started that a couple years ago. And then, oh my gosh, how do we go to the cloud? And you have to bring in cloud people, which make a good amount of money. And then you start down that path and you realize that you have to fix your data and fix your inputs to get it ready to go to the cloud. So there you're spending, you know, a couple hundred million fixing that. And then you're bringing in technical folks that do things that the military folks don't understand. They just know they need to do it, right? Because somebody told them they did. And that's how a lot of the spend happens is, oh, we want to do this. And then somebody like you that's an expert will come and say, well, before you do this, you have to do this. And then, oh, shoot. So now that contract is put on hold. We roll a bunch of money into another contract and let out another couple, $10, $20, $50 million. So you understand scale. I did a enterprise IT integration, a very small organization, 600 people. I realized I needed about $16 million to do this, right? To do a data integration. You know what I had to do to get that $16 million? I had to find it in like unspent money. And I said, hey, I want that $16 million recoded to me to do this. And that took one question to the right person. And all of a sudden I had $16 million to spend. And I went to a contractor and I said, hey, this is what I need. And they said, yep, we'll do that. And there you go. And I spent $16 million like that because I knew what I needed. No, and they knew what they needed, but I knew technically what we needed. So I built the program around it and actually ended up being a really good implementation, but that doesn't happen that often. And even now, that was 8 or 9 years ago, they're still working through the implementation and change management of that original contract. So that's how you end up with all these very highly paid people because they know what they want, they think. They don't know how to get there. And as long as you have somebody with at least a minimum level of technical knowledge, they can move in that direction. But a lot of times you don't have somebody with technical knowledge. So they'll fits and starts. For this project in specific, we had two major consulting companies that had consulted for $5 to $7 million a pop on designing a solution. And then when the implementation came, they're like, oh, we don't have any money for that. So they'd spend another $3 or $4 million defining the solution again. So that's how you get all this crazy spend in the government and not necessarily the value out of it, right? So that's, you know, long story longer. That's kind of where I've seen the government work and, you know, the efficiencies of the government are the efficiencies of the government.
Right. Efficiency of government sounds like an oxymoronic phrase.
It is. But, I can say that. I think maintain my position. Yeah. It's pretty defensible.
What's coming to mind for me right now is what percent of government spending is inefficient?
Right. Well, so that begs the question, right? So like it's an investor podcast. Where the big question that I'm working with the altimetry team is, if we take that $5 trillion the government spends every year, at what point does some of that or what a part of that becomes investable, right? Which part is really an investment? Where is it going to be a place where a company or the government organization is going to find a value or return? Because if you look at, you know, large platforms is one thing, right? So, you know, F-35, that's a lot of money went a lot of, and that almost died on the vine several times. But it came through. If you look at some of the programs and platforms that the Army is pursuing right now, Future Vertical Lift, right? The cool next generation V-22 helicopter that can take off vertically and then turn into an airplane, right? It's like some Transformer stuff that got funded, right? And there's a big, you know, futuristic bunch of helicopters that came, that were brought forward as potentials. And the government paid for most of that experimentation to get there. Now they've got this thing, right? And now we plan on implementing and building that program out and start delivering it by like 2028. But it's 2024, right? Am I going to see, is my kid, when he joins the Army, like he says he wants to, who knows, is he going to be flying that thing? I wouldn't even flip a coin on it. Like, I don't know if I'd make that bet. But it's just, it's it's kind of how the government works. It needs significant political backing. The products now, the bigger they are, the more broad they are. So the more people are involved in it. So you get, like, you build an F-35 and, like, I think it has a component in all 50 states to include all of our international partners, throw a little piece into it. So imagine all the businesses involved in building this very complex thing that has to fit together in a very precise way. Efficiencies of the government, right? So it's a very interesting problem set. And like I said, trying really hard to figure out how government spending is something you can bet on in the short, mid, and long term as an investor. So it's you know, giving that perspective, you know, talking to the altimetry guys, it's been a very interesting problem set. And I mean, we've definitely made some ground on it. And made some pretty decent recommendations, because if you look, there are companies that have their fingers in a lot of, because it's so broad, and there are winners and losers out there. But, you know, it's interesting. It's very interesting battle. We'll call it a battlefield. You can call it an industry.
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
That, yeah, the pluses and minuses of government contracts, for the real output, there's a lot of inefficiencies, but also from the investment level, those companies are locked up in those contracts, and the government is locked up in them for however long.
We can talk about, I mean, not to get into specific companies, but there's, you know, major American aircraft manufacturer that has a lot of trouble on the commercial side. It's doing okay on the federal side, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wonder who that is. John, I want to get as sort of as granular and detailed and intimate as you'll allow here. What does your, day, week, month, year kind of look like? Like, what are you personally focused on in the business?
So right now with MBO, I'm trying to find companies that have a need for a contingent workforce that realize that need. Now, what I found
For what?
For a contingent workforce. So like
contingent workforce.
They're different. Okay. They're different contract types, right? And whether it's a short term or long term contract, short term, you need to really specialize people for a certain duration, which makes sense to hire them in a contingent model versus do like some companies do and hire. For example, there's a large consulting company that I've worked with that is literally has about $3 or $4 million a year in spend on people sitting on the bench. Right, waiting for a contract to win. Because contracts have a schedule, but the government rarely follows that schedule. Like, for example, that the aircraft I was telling you about. You know, they say 2028. I think it's out to 2030. So, I mean, it's a sliding scale, right? If you're looking at a professional services contract, it may be a $500 million integration contract. Well, if that aircraft, which is on a separate contract vehicle, moves to the right, and then you've already awarded and delivered the cash for the integration of an aircraft that has yet to exist, you're burning the money, right? Or if that company has started to hire ahead of need and that award is pushed out as well, so they're having to sit on 30, 40, 50, 200 highly paid individuals, that's kind of where I'm looking at. It's like, hey, you're sitting on this revenue drain. I can provide you more of a positive revenue neutral solution to this problem. That's really what I spend my day looking for is finding these companies. And then the ones that do have a current need and they say they don't use a contingent workforce, I said, well, let me take a look, right? And in every instance I've found where everybody uses a contingent workforce, SMEs, subject matter experts, specialized engineers, specialized IT folks, they use them, but they're hiring them directly at the PM level or at the VP, the ops level, and it's not visible to the company at large, which is a inefficient, kind of use of that talent, because, business unit A and business unit B need the same thing. A has a line on it, B doesn't. B spends, talent sourcing is plus 30%, 40%. Depending on how you source it, while there are other business units sitting on that talent and not using it, right? So I try to connect the dots there, and that's really where I try to create value for the companies that I'm pursuing. And at the same time, I learn a hell of a lot about government contracting and where the money is being spent and isn't.
You know something, John? as a guy who did not go to business school, and who knows that, you know, some things come out of people who did go to business school, like when they're talking about investments, that I just scratch my head and I don't know what they mean. I guess I'm starting to get the feeling, oh, maybe some stuff they learned in business school really is worth something, because, you know, that's what it sounds like. It sounds like I'm getting this sort of how the stuff you learned in business school is actually worth something in the real world. You know, it's the 101 of that.
By God, you hope so. So the benefit that I had, I was going through business school. At the same time, I was going through the Army's Advanced Planners course, which is kind of like the business school for the Army. Like, in business school, you go in the nuts and bolts of processes and manpower and administration, all those things. And then on the military side, you go into the nuts and bolts of how you build a task organization, i.e. what kind of a force is needed to do a certain job. You know, you gotta have efficiency because you only have so much stuff. You want to do the most with it that you can. And by going through those courses at the same time, it's given me a very interesting perspective on the industry now, where, you know, I look at these military problems, and then I look at the resources that the military has and that I know they have and where they're trying to get to. And then there's that gap, right? And how do you fill it, right? And you can't fill it by increased manpower, because you've seen how well we're doing with recruiting. And if it's mid or senior level people, well, you got to take 10 or 15 years to build them, right? So then you try to bring in a contractor, which is a retired military person, to kind of fill that gap. But for how long and in what way, right? When we rolled out, you guys remember the Stryker vehicle? Back in the middle of, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, it was a wheeled armored vehicle. It looked like a Marine Corps LAV. 8x8, it was an awesome truck, right?
Okay.
Really fast, really capable. Well, the Army didn't have anybody that could actually fix it. So GD Land Systems, we can say this because it's in the past in the news. There was a coup for them, because they not only sold us the vehicle, they sold us all the maintenance schedule to fix that vehicle for a good number of years, until we had trained up the you know, military force to be able to fix that. So that's the kind of contracts, if you take a look at, it's like GDIT had a big, or GD Land Systems had a big win there, where, you know, they made not the money, not just the money from the truck, but also the money from all the parts, all the labor, and all the personnel to fix those things around the world.
Does somebody in your company specialize in eliminating waste? I'm just curious because I'm sitting here thinking, John must see, like, when you told me that one part from every 50 state thing, I was just like, yeah, you're kidding me. And I, as you're talking, all these things I'm putting together in my head, I'm like, John must see so much waste that he just, you know, that might not, it's like not part of your job, so you got to push it on somebody else. Does that guy exist? I mean, or is the government just not interested in that? There's no place for such a person.
It depends on the administration, the time, and the budget, right? So if you have money to burn, which, you know, we're in one of those time periods where it seems like we might, we definitely don't look at it that way. But when things contract, then you start finding, you know, trying to build efficiencies, right? So that's short answer to a challenging question is, does the government need that? Yes, they do. But does the government have that? Oh, certainly they don't.
Okay.
Well, they have it in name, but in effect, I'd venture
to say. I'm asking specifically at MBO Partners, does someone specialize in creating efficiencies for clients?
So really for... So efficiencies for clients. So yes. So our workforce model is very much in line with that. So creating efficiencies in their manpower flow and their personnel flow, their talent finding exercises, for sure.
Thank goodness. This had to be a major piece of the business, or else there's something wrong with the world, right? I mean,
what do you find that?
Yeah. Go ahead, Corey.
What do you find are the biggest needs of the companies that you're interacting with right now, like maybe one or two surprising things that, you know, most people might not understand?
So on the technical side, right? Data, big data, moving data, using data. Mm-hmm. A lot of federal contractors and the federal government at large are not good at using it. They have a ton of it, right? So as an example, we were flying helicopters, and we had these sensors in the helicopters that were testing vibrations, and they were trying to get it so you could take these vibrations and determine when a part or piece was going to go bad on the helicopter. Because normally you say, when you design a helicopter, okay, this piece has 100 hours in it, this is 1,000, this is 3,000, whatever. But they're trying to go more towards a condition-based replacement because it's expensive. Because especially when you're flying, like in combat, we flew the hell out of the airframes that we had. And we were finding that some parts lasted longer than we thought, and some were not as, didn't last as long as we thought. And finding by failure is no way to really find something, right? Especially in something that involves the third dimension and helicopters, which doesn't like, a helicopter doesn't like to fly. It just doesn't. Like an airplane, you shut the engine off, it's going to glide. It's going to continue to fly for a little bit. A helicopter, you shut the engine off, it's going to land somewhere where you're looking down. Like that's pretty much where it's going. It's not going very much further. So we try to do this, right? And this was before, you know, the compute, this is early 2000s. We didn't really have the computing power to really determine this. So we had all this data and all this experience and all these things, but we didn't really have a way to use that to create value. Now we're getting there. Now we're realizing that, in the case of a lot of the things where we thought, well, this wouldn't work or this doesn't work, we found that we have the data on hand. We can go back and analyze it and fix it and clean the data and come to some really good conclusions. So that's really the biggest, not the biggest, but one of the bigger spaces where I see a lot of requirements coming out against is data management, those type of things. And then the intelligence side, it's even bigger.
The intelligence side. Well, now you've piqued my interest. I mean, what can you even say about that part of the business?
Well, there's a lot of sources of intelligence, right? So you have your people, your human intelligence, you have all your signals intelligence, you have all the stuff that comes out in the public domain from social media, all of the data surrounding humans, right? And then how do you find, like you see in the news, the guy that was just arrested out west for that was going to conduct the attack on election day, right? That was a data problem. I mean, granted, the guy ended up trying to buy his weapons from an undercover FBI agent, but that FBI agent needed to know where to be and how to contact that guy. They didn't they didn't set out a line and start fishing for him, from the beginning. He just kind of fell into that circumstance. You hear about that all the time, but that's really data analysis where they use a lot of available intelligence data and find people that are looking to do bad things.
Okay. Well, we all want to find people looking to do bad things so we can avoid them or arrest them or whatever our job is. So, John, for some guests, I don't have to ask them to do a lot of work. I just want them to talk, and I've wanted you to talk and just sort of, tell me what's on your mind and very freely express yourself. But I'm going to have to ask you to do a little work now.
Sure.
Because at this point in our conversation, I'm pretty sure our listener is saying, my head's kind of swimming. Like, we've talked about some specific things like the FBI example, and the helicopter and various things that you've discussed.
Big government. But,
right. Big government. We all understand. And, the proliferation of consultants and all the rest of it. But I'm willing to bet that many of our listeners right at this point are saying, wait a minute. I still don't completely understand what this guy does for a living. Can you make it like really concrete for them?
Sure. What I do right now is I provide personnel solutions, right? If you have it's usually a technical or a high level administrative need. I help you fill that need. So looking at, administrative.
And I'm usually, and when you say you, I'm usually government, or I'm usually government adjacent?
Government adjacent. So we don't go direct B2G, at least not much, just because the government wants to solve, so government contracting has taken a turn in the last couple of years where they're, instead of going for specific small contracts, they put together these giant overarching contract vehicles where, if I need HR help, if I need IT integration, if I need all these things, I can go to this one contract vehicle, which is what it's kind of like a store, right? And I can find somebody that is a winner of that contract vehicle. So there's, a large contract will have 5, 6, 7 winners. that can provide these services. So I decide what kind of service I need. I go to my contracting office and say, hey, I have this need. And they'll help me craft my, you know, my contract that goes to a company, right? And to deliver that. So when that company gets it, they're going to have part of the people, right? And part of the specialties to do that. So what I do is I look for those opportunities to help them fill the rest. Because when you're doing these contracts, and a lot of them are task orders that are time bound. So 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 3 months, right? They can't go out and hire against this because number one, their hiring timeline is usually pretty long. And number two, I have access to literally 100,000 contractors worldwide that can potentially fill these roles. So they'll come to us and say, okay, I have this need. And then we fill that gap for them for that period of time so that they don't have to go and, you know, hire. And it's good in a lot of ways because one, you get specialized talent that wants to work for you. Because when you hire an independent contractor or a consultant to help you out, that person is motivated to help you. They're not nothing against a W-2 worker because I am one, right? But a W-2 guy, and this is in the government and in some commercial instances I've seen, the day you're hired, that person is always already on the job site looking to level up, right? Especially in the cleared space. If you got a top secret clearance and you're in it, you know, 100K or 80K, you know that you can jump yourself to 120, 150 with a little bit of experience because you already have that clearance, right? So the nice thing about a contingent workforce is you know that they're tied in and interested for that period of performance to get that contract done. And that's the value that I provide is providing you that workforce that's going to do that job and stick around, you know, for the duration of the contract. It's a common thing. The last year of a contract, like if it's a
I see what you're telling me.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. Year three, so the W-2 guy, he's hired. And as soon as he's there, he wants to move up and do something else. Right. But the contractor guys, you know, they're going to stick to the contract and get it done and not be angling for another position. Maybe.
Right. Way more likely. Cause they want to do okay. business with you again. Right. They want to be on that next contract, maybe a little higher rate, but they're very interested in building a good relationship with you. If they hang you out to dry, if you're the company and the contractor leaves, are you going to hire them again? Probably not.
Right. So, and you have a Rolodex of 100,000 of these people around the world?
Yes. The MBO's got actually over 100,000 now.
Wow. That,
so we work with commercial and government, everything.
Yeah. How does a person who wants to be a contractor get hooked up with you guys? Like, how does that process work?
So our website's a good place to start. You know, hit me on LinkedIn, especially if you're a military type of person or a government type of person, hit me on LinkedIn. I've got a book behind me, how to literally soup the nuts on how to be a government contracting independent consultant. It's easier for the non-government commercial side, but there's a process out there. We help people do it on our website. And then, sometimes I've helped probably about 100 people do it in the last year, you know, myself.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's a good opportunity for a lot of folks. They just don't know that the gig economy is a little bit bigger than some of the, you know, classic instances.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You hear about the gig economy and, you know, freelancing and whatnot, but to get in that contract mode, like people hear a contract and they're like, all right, well, what do I do after the end of 1 or 2 years? Right. But if you're saying you get hooked up over and over again, if you actually do the work.
These contractors, the ones that are successful, they'll have 6 or 7 clients. So they'll do 2-3 months with one guy, 2-3 months with another girl, you know, whatever, just to build their book of business. So they're not, you know, tied or over risked to one separate company or one company.
That's interesting. That's an interesting way to think about that. Most people think they just want to get a job and get with one company and stick there. Like, that's not a risky thing. Like, there's no risk in it. Well, they feel safe with that.
Yeah. You look at, well, even, you know, Gen Xers, right? Our duration, our common duration with a company is like 4 years. There's very few people that are spending an entire career with one company, especially in the professional side. You see a lot of folks bounce around and then you get, you know, Gen Z and younger, they really are looking to, you know, kind of turn a little bit faster. They don't have as much allegiance to the company like we would think of, like, I'm a booze guy, I'm a PwC guy, I'm a whatever. They're, mm-hmm. I'm going to work here for a little bit and then I'm going to bump up at the next one. They're much more, you know, nomadic in their pursuits.
Right. And I want our listeners to know when he says not a booze guy, he's not talking about drinking excessive amounts. It's
right.
Booze Allen Hamilton. Yeah. Booze Allen Hamilton. I've recommended them in the Extreme Value newsletter. They've done well.
In Vegas, Dan, we can talk. I've got some good insights for you.
All right. Can't wait to hear it. So, okay. So thanks for that. Thanks for just helping me, just make things more concrete, for our listener. That's really what we want to do here. You think, like, what size is MBO? Do you think it'll ever go public?
So I think we're on our second, private equity company.
Okay.
Honestly, there's a lot of green space, right? I think it could go public at some point. It should go public at some point. There's some things that need to happen with industry. Like, you know, if you look at our MBO is the largest source for research on the independent gig economy. Like, we do a thing, it's called the, we have an annual report that's kind of the state of independence is what we call it, where we talk about, hey, this is what
that's cool. How did I not know this about you? That's awesome.
Oh, well, that's why I'm here. That's why you have me to talk.
We're learning, Dan.
Yes. I know.
So yeah, the state of independence actually should come out in October. So this year's will come out and it'll give you an idea of where the independent workforce is growing, is contracting, kind of the health of it. But what we found, I mean, really consistent in the research is it's been growing immensely since even pre-pandemic. Pandemic was definitely a shot in the arm. And then if you look at the independents, the independent contractors, the people who have done this, they're actually healthier, wealthier, and happier as they build out their personal business. So it's, you know, the Miles, our CEO, has actually started talking about, you know, there's a new social contract, right? Social contract isn't with, you know, the business, it's with the worker. So the worker has to be able to take their benefits with them, right? And then we help independents do that. We have different programs in place. But you really, as you look at it, you're not going to get a pension. I mean, who has pensions anymore other than the military? And I appreciate that. But who has pensions anymore? You got to be able to take your benefits and take them with you and build a system that, you know, when you bring somebody into a business, whether it's a new hire or a contractor, you have to be able to contribute to their livelihood, you know, in the long term, not just, you know, providing them a job in the short run.
Makes me feel really weird. I've been at Stansberry literally longer than absolutely everyone, arguably including Porter, because he left for a couple of years. He's, you know,
right. See, Porter's got
I've been there every
service.
Year. Yeah,
he's got a break in service.
Yeah. So, so not everyone is like me. Lots of people not like more than ever.
I mean, I did 25 like years in the Army, so I'm with you, Dan.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, 25
yeah,
years,
like
really.
Yeah.
Did you retire full bird?
I did.
Nice. My brother retired lieutenant colonel, Marine Corps. If he hadn't hurt his back, he wouldn't
retire then, but I didn't. I forgot.
You forgot.
Like, pretty literally. It's like, oh my gosh, now I'm a colonel and now it's 25. I think it's time now.
Yeah. So you mentioned the possibility of your son joining up. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think he'll have a lot of the advantages I didn't have. Like, I was the only member of my immediate family to serve. My grandfather served in World War II for a couple of years. He peaked at E5. So he started at E1 and ended at E1. Peaked at E5. So you can tell he was the kind of soldier that I would have had trouble with.
Yeah. I don't even want to ask, you know, like what right. got him busted
his,
back.
His story is, it comes very clear, very fast. Just put it this way. Before he joined the army at 16, he lied about his age. He was a leader of a gang on Long Island.
Oh, Long Island. That's where I'm from originally. Where part?
Oh, was it by Rockaway, I think?
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So he said by Willie Mays' house, wherever that is, that's where you grew up.
That sounds okay. About right. Okay. Yeah.
That's how he described it, by Willie Mays' house. But yeah. And then he became a civil engineer, started an engineering company, did great. But yeah, he got all of his wild oats out of him in the Great World War.
Sounds right. like
I
it.
Wanted, while we do have you here, I do want to ask about, you know, the current wars going on right now, you know, the major ones. We got obviously Russia, Ukraine, and then what's going on with Israel and everything, Iran in the Middle East.
Yeah.
How do you, is a hard question to answer, but how do you see this progressing? You know, you could go through, you know, whatever developments every other day, but where does this end up?
So the trend, right? If you look at, we'll start with the easy. I won't say these. Neither of them are easy. But with Ukraine, I think we've reached kind of the end game with that. I'm guessing 18 months we'll have it all figured out. And my call is that Russia will maintain the eastern territories in Crimea, I believe, and they'll kind of just redraw the lines, right? And Ukraine will become Kiev, surrounding areas of Odessa. And then Russia will maintain that. Now, that position isn't without risk for Russia, just given the fact that Ukraine is getting a little bit more capable. But both are really running out of resources. So I think that one we've reached the end game. And I don't think you're going to see anything huge, right? Because the manpower, the capability just isn't there. With Israel and Iran and proxies, very interesting. There's nothing stopping Israel from, I won't say eliminating, it'd be hard to eliminate, but at least making ineffective Hamas and Hezbollah. Nothing is stopping Israel from expanded operations in Lebanon. I think that will continue. I think the interesting part of that, and I think at the end, Gaza will go back, probably a UN mission in there. West Bank is a big question mark right now because they haven't really, they've done some, but not a whole lot there. I don't know where that one's going to be. And I think the West Bank folks have seen the things to the north and south and are kind of, you know, self-regulating and keeping things, you know, even keel there. And for the most part, historically, that's been one of the lesser risk areas because you don't have Hamas or Hezbollah there right now. I mean, you had the PLO for a while. That's kind of, you know, softened. I think that will be, you know, I think we'll continue operations into Lebanon for another, you know, 6 months. But that one's definitely tipped hard, you know, in the Israelis' favor. Now, the wild card is the Houthis. The Houthis have been causing a lot of trouble for a lot of people. And what people don't realize is their attacks in the Red Sea have been very specific, right? If you look at the amount of traffic that they've interdicted or shot, they're fired upon, there is a method to their madness. They're not shooting at everybody. They're shooting at either Israeli flagged vessels, companies that do a lot of business with Israel, a lot of things that are aligned with Israel. So they've been very targeted. And they've actually increased their operations in Iraq and kind of more in the area. So the Houthis may take the place of Hamas and Hezbollah at some point. I'm not sure because they are geographically tied to Yemen. So that's a consideration because of the strategic importance of Yemen vice the Red Sea. That is a significant, you know, international, global, you know, shipping risk there. So I think that is an interesting thing to watch in that conflict. Is Iran going to get into a shooting war with Israel more than they have? I don't think that's in anybody's best interest. I think I think Iran's going to double down on the Houthis because of their effectiveness and kind of their ability to stay outside the fray and still affect global shipping, provide them a bit more of a lever than Hezbollah and Hamas, which were very focused on, you know, Israel. That's kind of my take there. I think the big question mark for me is what becomes of the Houthis and how does that, you know, how does Yemen end up in the greater, you know, Arabian Peninsula, you know, Middle East kind of structure, right? How do we respond to that? We Americans, we NATO, we global community. What does that become? Because, you know, just a few years ago, Saudi Arabia was launching their Apache helicopters into Yemen to shoot Houthis. They're not anymore, right? So that one for me is very interesting. I think I don't think anything's going to stop Israel from greatly degrading Hezbollah and Hamas capability. I mean, you've seen a masterclass in counterinsurgency in the last, you know, 3 or 4 months. I mean, everybody on this side is like, why couldn't we have done that against ISIS? Or, you know, I mean, yeah. We don't have the Mossad or all the other units that Israel has and the timeline that they've been working on to penetrate into that infrastructure. So that's my take on the global ones. Like I said, the big one for me is what becomes of the Houthis and how do they play, you know, on the world stage as the other, you know, kind of proxies are degraded.
All right. Very interesting. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Because the latest thing we have, or I've heard at least, is you have the Iranian president and Putin scheduled to meet soon. And I presume they're not talking about, you know, Major League Baseball playoffs or anything like that.
It could be like, you know, they're just having a birthday celebration, like, you know, North Korea. but it's interesting. And you know, the reports of North Korean soldiers fighting in Ukraine is also of interest. But I don't see there being a lot of appetite for that internationally. I think we can shut that off, you know, through different actions. But I don't know. That's a wild card there. It's not as big a wild card as the Houthis, but I think it's a wild card for the Ukraine conflict.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that. That's crazy. I thank you, John, for being here and for, you know, just letting us kind of pepper you almost randomly with questions about, you know, your current business and your past career and what's going on in the world. I appreciate your accommodating our wide-ranging questions. But it is time for our final question, which is the same for every guest, no matter what the topic, even if it's a non-financial topic, same identical question. And if you've already said the answer, by all means, feel free to repeat it. So just take your time if you need to. But the final question is simple for every guest. If you could just leave our listeners with a single thought today, what would you like it to be?
Yeah. I had an answer to this, but it was given our discussion, I've rethought it. I think my answer to that would be is everybody should be comfortable that the United States is still in a position of power and influence in the world. What we need to be careful of is how we wield and use that power and influence. And if it's in the best interest of both this country and other countries that are involved in those decisions. So I think as you look at, because it's election season and all these, I don't know if this is coming out before elections or not, but as we look at how we view our place in the world and what's important to us as Americans, I think that people need to really consider what's important and how to create the best position for ourselves that also allows other people to thrive. Because once you really shift that balance of power and you exploit it, then people use that against you. And then you end up with, you know, global disruptions, unrest and conflict, which is something that nobody wants. I mean, 25 years in the army, you know, over 5 years in a combat situation, nobody wants that. You don't want your kids to go there, but you need to be prepared for when and if it happens, because, you know, people make bad decisions, whether they're, you know, world leaders or the guy next door. just, you know, as you think about where we are in the world, you can be very comfortable that the United States is strong and has, you know, great people at the helm. But as you frame your opinions and thoughts about things, think about, you know, both yourself and then, you know, all those around you. How do we make the best decisions to use our great power and resources to make the best for kind of everybody, right?
All right. Well, thanks for that. And thanks for being here, John. I really enjoyed it.
I did too, Dan. This went fast. You know, it's yeah. Too bad, but I'm it looking forward does. To seeing you out in Vegas and having a little conversation there, and we'll have a couple of days to do that. So
yeah, looking forward to it.
We will see you there.
I had no idea how that was going to go, so I really am delighted that it was so enjoyable and just kind of easy and freewheeling. Mm-hmm. And we hit them from all sides on the questions, didn't we? It was great.
Yeah, it was, you know, fascinating conversation. I mean, he's got 25 years in the Army, and then obviously he's in private life now with MBO partners. So there was a lot to talk about, and it was interesting because, mm-hmm. you know, we talked about kind of gig economy trends, big government spending. And to me, you know, listening to, and then obviously the war is going on in Russia, Ukraine, and the Middle East. And to me, I'm like adding all of this up and thinking, just to me, I'm what I usually think is more inflation, more government spending, more threats for inflation. Remember, he's talking about the Red Sea as being a wild card still. And yeah, it's the costs of everything to me. Unfortunately, that's where my head goes.
Yeah, that's me too. I wonder, you know, like I was asking the questions that reflected this, but I wonder, like, a bright guy like this, who, you know, he's been to business school and, you know, he has a head for these things, and working adjacent to the government all the time, like, I wouldn't be able to do it. I would be constantly pointing out all the waste and inefficiency and absurdity. I'm sure that, you know, a lot of these contracts are probably things the government shouldn't even be doing. You know what
right.
I'm saying? So,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, you just have to be like constantly,
yeah.
yes, biting your tongue and just swallowing all this stuff. And I mean, I worked in Alexandria in the late 80s for the Electronic Data Interchange Association. And I just, even just what I saw in that short period, and then I worked on my own as a consultant for a year or two after that. And just during that time, I thought, man, like, I couldn't wait to get out of there. I couldn't wait to leave that life. It was like, it was one of the worst 3-year periods, maybe the worst 3-year period of my life.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. In the late 80s to through about mid 1990 or so, when I finally got the hell out of there. And I just, well, you know, it started with me like, commuting from Cockeysville, Maryland to 17th and L in Washington, D.C., 2 hours one way, like half of it driving, half of it on the metro. So it was like, you know, that's your day. That's how your day begins
yeah.
and ends.
Yeah, that's enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was interesting for me just to hear, you know, just to try to get him to be real concrete about the sort of things that he does. And, you know, he's finding people to fulfill these contracts. So, and he gave us a real window into how the contract works and the circumstances under which they kind of arise and how they need to be fulfilled. And they, you know, they can't hire people. They need, like, they can't live without this guy. They can't live without MBO partners. They've got to have somebody because they can't, you know, by the time they hire people, the contract would have to have been fulfilled, you know, in
right,
some cases.
Right. Yeah. So that's the other point. Yeah. That's the other big point I'm taking from this is just the size. Again, we know this, but the size of government. And you talk about, you know, a lot of times people use the analogy like moving a battleship, but this is like, I don't know, just a freighter that's stuck in, you know, it's in a sandbar. And is mm-hmm. not going to move for a very long time, if ever. just the amount of, which again is also can be an opportunity. A lot of these companies that have the contracts that, you know they're going to have business for 10 or, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, whatever it may be.
Yeah, that's like the whole rationale behind the defense stocks that I've got in both publications, Ferris Report and Extreme Value. It's just like, part of it is like, look, I mean, you know, this source of revenue is certainly never going to go away. You know, there's a chance it might not go to this company, but it's gone to them like every year for decades. So, you know, what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah. And as frustrating as it is to hear about, you know, practically, you know, it's there.
It is there.
The money's there. So.
And you, as an investor, you're like, well, I need to get some of this back that they're taking away from me. So it's kind of like a way to assuage the pain you feel at paying taxes. You know, is buy defense. If you feel bad about paying taxes, just buy the defense contractor stocks and, you know, you'll collect really nice dividends. And lately you're getting pretty good capital appreciation the last few years. So,
yeah.
All right. Really interesting conversation. And that's another interview and another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we really, truly did. We do provide a transcript for every episode. Just go to www.investorhour.com. Click on the episode you want. Scroll all the way down. Click on the word transcript and enjoy. If you like this episode and know anybody else who might like it, tell them to check it out on their podcast app or at investorhour.com, please. And also, do me a favor, subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, help us grow with a rate and a review. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is @InvestorHour. On Twitter, our handle is @Investor_Hour. Have a guest you want us to interview? Drop us a note at feedback@investorhour.com or call our listener feedback line, 800-381-2357. Tell us what's on your mind and hear your voice on the show. For my co-host, Corey McLaughlin, until next week, I'm Dan Ferris. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. To access today's notes and receive notice of upcoming episodes, go to investorhour.com and enter your email. Have a question for Dan? Send him an email, feedback@investorhour.com. This broadcast is for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered personalized investment advice. Trading stocks and all other financial instruments involves risk. You should not make any investment decision based solely on what you hear. Stansberry Investor Hour is produced by Stansberry Research and is copyrighted by the Stansberry Radio Network.
Opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the contributor and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Stansberry Research, its parent company, or affiliates. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this program as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of opinion. Neither Stansberry Research nor its parent company or affiliates warrant the completeness or accuracy of the information expressed on this program, and it should not be relied upon as such. Stansberry Research, its affiliates and subsidiaries are not under any obligation to update or correct any information provided on the program. The statements and opinions expressed on this program are subject to change without notice. No part of the contributor's compensation from Stansberry Research is related to the specific opinions they express. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Stansberry Research does not guarantee any specific outcome or profit. You should be aware of the real risk of loss in following any strategy or investment discussed on this program. Strategies or investments discussed may fluctuate in price or value. Investors may get back less than invested. Investments or strategies mentioned on this program may not be suitable for you. This material does not take into account your particular investment objectives, financial situation, or needs, and is not intended as a recommendation that is appropriate for you. You must make an independent decision regarding investments or strategies mentioned on this program. Before acting on information on the program, you should consider whether it is suitable for your particular circumstances and strongly consider seeking advice from your own financial or investment advisor.